Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the classic Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Deities and Demigods supplement. And as I do, I'm talking about the, well, deities and demigods that I find in it. In our last episode, we got started on the topic of Norse mythology, and we spent most of the episode, after our short overview, talking about the primary, deity of the Norse pantheon, Odin. Having done that, we're now about to move on to some of the other gods of Scandinavian mythology, and hopefully we're not going to take as long on any one of them, so we should be able to knock out a couple in this episode. So let's get started. Now, as with every section, the Norse mythology section of this book starts with the supreme deity of the pantheon and then lists the remaining ones in alphabetical order. So we're going to get started with Aegir, the god of the sea. I say Aegir, it could be Aegir, actually. Like, I gotta be honest, I get my pronunciation mixed up, and I know I said Aesir a bunch of times last time. It's really Aesir, I think. Think that A is a short A rather than, like, an A sound. But... you know, it's a force of habit. I've been saying it for a long time, and so it's hard for me to say it a different way, even if that way is more likely to be correct. Anyway, Aegir, or Aegir, is the god of the sea, and as you might expect from a maritime culture, the Vikings had a lot of sea gods. Not only is he the god of the sea, but he's also married to Ran, who is also kind of a goddess of the sea, although she doesn't get an entry in this section, which is kind of a rip. What's interesting about him is that if we look at the poetic sources, the sea stuff is not really what he's mostly known for. Now, he's also not a member of one of the two main tribes of gods, the Aesir and the Vanir. He's described as a giant. He's also given a couple of different names, including Clair and Gimir. And there's another giant called Gimir. I'm not sure they're the same person, but he's going to turn up when we talk about the characters of Frey and Skirnir. So, I mean, maybe it's the same guy. It's probably not, though, for complicated reasons. Anyway, Aegir is the god of the sea, and he seems to be, you know, your basic sea god. He's got particularly the idea that he's someone that you have to propitiate before undertaking a sea voyage, right? And that's even in his description in the Monster Manual, is that he is someone who attacks sailors who haven't sacrificed to him. Now, of course, in the mythology, what that is to say is that people who don't sacrifice to Aegir before they embark on a sea voyage get shipwrecked. There's a description in the... did I say Monster Manual earlier? Obviously, I mean Deities and Demigods book. Again, force of habit. There's a description in the book earlier that says that Aegir attacks people with a club in the shape of a maiden. Now, the only thing I can think this might be a reference to is that Aegir and Ran have 9 daughters. And the 9 daughters are waves. You know, each of them is a different kind of wave. And so a term for waves is Aegir's daughters, or Ran's daughters. But the place where Aegir most turns up is actually not in, at least in the poetry, is not in the context of being a sea god, but in the context of being the host of a gathering. He's often referred to as someone who is good at brewing. He has a special cauldron that he was given by Thor following the events of a fight between Thor and some giants. And he is the host of the party at which Loki insults all of the gods and goddesses one after another in the poem Lokasenna. And there we see this thing about Aegir, which is that the gods respect him. He isn't necessarily one of them, and they're constantly pleading with Loki not to disgrace the gods or start any trouble in Aegir's hall. So the idea being that he's maybe not the kind of person that you would want to cross. I mean, as much as the descriptions in the Deities and Demigods book may vary somewhat from the mythology, I think here we see pretty much what we'd expect from Aegir, you know, as the personification of an elemental force, someone who's powerful and a little bit unpredictable, you know, kind of like the sea. Someone that the gods treat as an equal, but who isn't necessarily one of them and not bound by the same rules as them. We also learn about Ran that she has a net that she uses to catch people who fall into the sea. So I guess she's kind of a Davy Jones sort of a character, right? Like, when you drown, that's where you go. And that's fitting because her name means something like plunder. And they're both kind of associated with treasure, actually. A common kenning. Have we talked about kennings? In Old Norse poetry, a kenning is a sort of poetic simile. So here, common expression for gold is the fire of Aegir. And it's like this, It's based on a story in which, instead of having a fire in his hall, Aggier just puts down a big pile of gold, and that's what illuminates the room. Now, this may be because the idea is that his hall is underwater, and therefore, obviously, there can't be a fire there, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the poem Locasana that suggests that it's not underwater at all. So, for example, when the first time Loki does something wrong, the Æsir chase him away, and he goes to the woods. You know, so clearly there's a forest nearby, which doesn't sound like something that's under the sea, but I guess it could be like a kelp forest. Aggier has two servants called Eldir and Fimafeng, and I don't think they're particularly important. They're excellent servants, and everyone praises them, and Loki hates the idea of someone being praised like that so much that he kills one of them. And this is a recurring thing that we're going to see with Loki, this idea that he's motivated by envy. Anyway, we talked last time about how clerics and paladins of Odin would be complex and ambiguous figures. I don't think that's necessarily true for this god. He's certainly kind of wild and unpredictable like the sea, but very much what you see is what you get. He does have a relationship with some other cults in that it seems like the god Heimdall is his grandson. Because Heimdall is said to be born of nine maidens, that he's the son of nine mothers, and that suggests, I think, that those are the nine daughters of Ran and Aegir. So Aegir doesn't have much of a described personality. In fact, in Locasana, when he invites people to the feast, he actually does not appear. He's the host, but he's not really in the poem at all. So he just sort of presides over the gathering, but doesn't seem to actually be a guest at it. And the other place that he turns up is in the prose Edda, where he is actually described as a human, this guy called Hler, who is greatly skilled in magic. And he comes to visit the gods and learn about them. But again, he just sort of fits in the role of the person who asks questions and then has them answered. We don't really see anything of what he is like. So we have to kind of figure this all out sort of by implication. So yeah, Aggier is that rare thing where he's, you know, the god of the sea. But he does have this other aspect, this sense of reinforcing the importance of hospitality and status in this culture. That these gods, are willing to tolerate severe insults rather than break the peace of Aggier's hall. And that could be because he's so powerful, or it could be just a demonstration of how important this principle is in this culture, or at least how important it's supposed to be. Indeed, Loki's insults end when Thor arrives at the gathering and just says that he'll kill Loki if Loki doesn't shut up, and Loki realizes that Thor is so dumb and aggressive that he actually would hit him, even though that would violate the peace that Aegir has imposed on the gathering. All right, next up we have Baldur. Now, Baldur's an interesting character. The prose Edda says about him that he is the best and all praise him. It describes him as wise, well-spoken, merciful, and beautiful. And it particularly goes into detail about how bright he is and says that there's a flower in Iceland, the Mayweed, which you actually also get in other places, you get in Northern England, is so bright and white that it's called Baldur's Brow. It then goes on to make the interesting point, says, although he has all of these qualities, none of his decisions is effective. Goes on again and describes his home, the Great Hall of Breidablik, and says no impurity may be there. So we have this idea of a god who is sort of bright and pure, he's merciful and wise, and yet no good ever seems to really come of it. Says no one can disagree with his judgments, but they never really work out anyway. And the story of Baldur is a story of everything being right and everything being perfect and it not working out, which is very interesting. And it's further interesting that Baldur's son, with his wife Nanna, is Forseti, the god of justice, and Forseti's decisions do seem to be effective. So he's sort of a little more sort of pragmatic or effectual, I guess, than his father. Now, Baldur's probably a light god or a day god. Baldur may come from a root that means day or brightness. It's also a word that's used to mean lord, but that's probably the other way around, that people use Baldur to mean lord. Because Baldur is, you know, the Lord, a god. Now, the main myth of Baldur that everyone is familiar with is, of course, the death of Baldur. Baldur is the second son of Odin. Important here to note that he is the first son of Odin and Frigg. Thor is Odin's son, but not Frigg's son. He's in fact, he's Frigg's half brother because he's His mother, if I recall correctly, is Fjörgyn, the Earth, who is also Frigga's mother. So that's weird. Anyway, so Baldr is sort of the prince, right? I mean, Thor is the go-get-stuff-done guy, but Baldr is the heir to Odin. Much more like Odin in terms of his qualities being things like wisdom, but without Odin's weird, mercurial, violent, dark side, and without Odin's effectiveness. So Baldr has a dream that he's going to die, and the gods decide to prevent this, and Frigg goes around and gets everything in the whole world to swear an oath not to hurt Baldr. But crafty Loki finds out that she left out one thing, the mistletoe, which she says is too young to swear an oath. So that's an interesting idea. This is a story that emphasizes the importance of oaths and rules in this society. Again, we have this stereotype of Viking society as a violent and barbaric one where everything was just kind of everybody lived by the sword. But that's not true at all. It had a complex and important legal system. And the idea that oaths are what keep society together, but that there are people who can't swear oaths, is an important one. Anyway, as you probably know, Loki then makes a dart out of mistletoe, and he goes and gets another of the gods, this guy Hod, who's blind, and therefore doesn't know that he's being tricked, and gets him to throw the mistletoe dart at Baldr, while everyone else is playing the fun game where they throw rocks and spears and stuff at Baldr, to prove that he's invulnerable. Baldr dies, goes to hell, there's a big funeral. Now, interesting thing here, Odin then has another son, Vali, who is only one day old when he avenges Baldr's death, not by killing Loki, but by killing Hod. So that's interesting. And there's another very different version of the story, told by Saxo Grammaticus. Now, Saxo Grammaticus took a lot of these myths and turned them into stories, had access to different versions of the stories, in which these are human characters, right? He was trying to write a history of the Danes. And in the Gesta Danorum, he writes about a war between two kings, or two rulers, Baldr and Hother. So for him, the key conflict is not between Baldr and Loki, but between Baldr and Hod. So that's interesting. You know, a lot of people feel like Hod getting killed in this myth, you know, it feels a bit unjust. Hod was tricked. He didn't really do anything. But maybe that doesn't matter, or, you know, maybe we're meant to understand the story in a different way. Anyway, another one of Odin's numerous heroic sons, this guy Hermod, goes down to hell and asks Baldr, you know, can anything be done about this? And he comes back with an agreement that says that if everything on Earth weeps for Baldr, then he will be returned. And that's supposed to be why things, quote-unquote, weep when the ice melts, basically. The coming of spring and summer is the world weeping for Baldr. And you can imagine that, you know, the snow is melting off the trees and the melting water is dripping off and running down. And they also talk about things being brought in from the cold outside into a warm room. And, of course, they start to kind of sweat, or, the frost on them starts to melt. And this is them weeping for Baldr. But one person will not, and that's a giantess called Thought, may or may not be Loki. Kind of interesting. I don't have the text to hand, but I think the prose edit says something like, you know, many people thought that this was Loki. So the story of Baldr is really interesting. It's a story of a perfect god who's brought low by one imperfection, and who is then not brought back because of one imperfection. Both times, it's a story about how everything is almost fine, and then one little thing gets in the way. Now, that's what Chesterton was talking about. In The Ballad of the White Horse, he actually has a bit about Baldr, where he says, "There's always one thing forgotten when all the world goes well. One thing forgotten, as long ago, the gods forgot the mistletoe." Baldr here seems like kind of a passive and ineffectual god, so it's hard to see. I mean, his main role is kind of sacrificial. He will ultimately return after Ragnarok, and he will be reconciled, again, not with Loki, but with Hod, who, sort of according to our standards, is kind of blameless, so it's hard to see why reconciliation would be such a big deal, right? So a cleric of Baldr, it's sort of not clear what they would do, right? They kind of go around, it almost seems like they would be very obsessed with kind of ritual purity, right? No impurity is allowed in Breidablik, but it doesn't seem like they'd be terribly useful. And I don't want to say that, well, this actually makes them a lot more like real world, you know, religious specialists than most D&D clerics are. But what I mean is that it seems like a cleric of Baldr would be primarily preoccupied with spiritual concerns rather than practical ones. Did I say that Thok means gratitude? That's interesting too. Ironic. Now, the entry for Baldr in the Deities and Demigods book, I gotta say, It's very interesting when you have a god whose particular quality is that he is beautiful. And they really go hard on the beautiful thing. In fact, they suggest that sort of the attribute that Baldur is the god of is charisma, which makes sense. So then when we look at the illustration, we can get an idea of what they thought was the most attractive a man could be. And it's absolutely a man, right? Like, Baldur cannot be attacked by a female of any species, even if she's compelled to do so. And mortal females who look upon him must immediately save or become enchanted by his beauty. You know, again, I think today we would think of that as kind of a heteronormative approach to thinking about Baldur, but more than that, at the same time, I gotta say that if we look at Baldur, you know, with his big bushy beard and his mustache and his, like, little fur boots and, you know, his loincloth, yeah, big beefy lad with, I like to think that if he turned around, we would see that he had a mullet. We do get a fascinating image of what the creators of this book in 1980 thought was the absolute pinnacle of masculine beauty. You know, I'm going to stick around throughout this book, and because we've certainly got a lot of goddesses, you know, for whom their beauty is their defining characteristic. There are lots of goddesses of love, and she's the most beautiful creature in all creation, etc., etc., etc. But I wonder how many more male characters we'll see and how they're going to be represented. Well, quite interesting. Anyway, so that's Baldur. I don't know that he'd be a ton of fun to play as a cleric. I like the idea of clerics of Forseti, who sort of write themselves, right? They're just sort of law speakers and judgment givers, but also worshipping and paying tribute to Baldur. Again, you know, we want to imagine a world in which people are not devoted to one particular god, but honor all the gods. And I think Baldur plays a sort of tragic, sacrificial role in that pantheon. But I don't know that you're going to get a lot of player characters selecting him as, you know, as their god. In Saxo Grammaticus, I think the sword with which Hod kills Baldur is called mistletoe, which seems like a just-so story, right? Oh, the myth says that Hod kills Baldur with mistletoe, but what they mean is the sword was called mistletoe. It does make mistletoe a pretty cool name for a sword if your players find it in your Norse-themed campaign, though. All right. Then we got Bragi, the god of poetry. Now, this is a culture that's very into poetry, right? One of the reasons that we have so much information about Norse mythology is because of the use of kennings in Old Norse poetry. Because of that, Snorri Sturluson wanted to make sure that everyone had a good understanding of the mythology so that they could understand the kennings. I mean, he himself was a Christian. Everyone reading this thing was a Christian. And that's why he was worried that they didn't understand the mythology well enough. But for the most part, I don't think Bragi is the patron of poetry. Remember when we talked about, in the last episode, Egil Skallagrimsson's poem Sonatorek, which incidentally is another one where he mentions Aegir, talks about the sea god depriving him of his son because he died in a shipwreck. But he doesn't credit his poetic inspiration to Bragi, he credits it to Odin. But Bragi, at the same time, is referred to as the best of skalds, that is, the best of poets. And in a list of kind of magical things that should have runes on them, one of them is on Bragi's tongue. So the idea that his tongue is magical. And again, that's supported by, or reflected in, I guess I should say, what we see here in Deities and Demigods, which is to say that Bragi kind of, you know, enchants people with his beautiful poetry. And it says that people don't fight in his presence. You know, one of the effects that he has is he instills peace with his poetry, which is again consistent with something that Loki says about him in Lokasenna. He says, of all the gods, you're the wariest of war. He calls him a pretty boy on a bench, and implies that Bragi is, you know, talking tough and threatening, but never actually follows through, that he is all words. Now, we've talked about, you know, the gods and their relations to clerics and paladins, obviously, and we've talked about druids when we talked about Sumerian mythology, but I think it's the first time bards have really come up, and, you know, bards fill a very important role, or skalds, I should say, in Old Norse society and in Old Norse literature. The idea of the warrior poet is a very important one, and there are lots of sagas that are specifically about people who are both famous poets but also go around having adventures. So an adventuring poet probably fits better in this type of implied setting than any other one, and you can see that that person would definitely be devoted by Bragi, not so much because Bragi created poetry, again, that was Odin, but because Bragi is the exemplar of poetry. In fact, there is an actual poet called Bragi the Old or Bragi the Elder. I want to say that I read somewhere the idea that Bragi is a great poet who becomes deified, but I don't think that's actually true. He shows up extensively in the Prose Edda, where he is kind of the character who explains the rules of poetry. You know, he's this person who teaches poetry. So again, in a culture that really prizes poetry, Bragi is kind of first and foremost. And I think, again, that does say something. It's a really good thing to introduce into your game to defy the stereotype of a barbarian culture. Because again, when we think about barbarians, we think about all this Conan the Barbarian nonsense, you know, crush your enemies, yada yada. You think about a society where violence is pervasive. And there is a lot of violence in early medieval Scandinavia, although again, there's a lot of violence everywhere. So it might kind of, you know, defy stereotypes to point out that this is actually also a culture where sort of the most respected people in it are, you know, not just warriors, but merchants and poets. You know, that's not what I thought of when I thought of hairy, warlike Vikings. But it's definitely true. So true that they have a god of poetry, unlike a lot of the other, you know, more quote-unquote civilized cultures that we're going to talk about. Although it's also curious that for such a poetic culture, Bragi is kind of neglected, and it's Odin, the god of kind of mystical, ecstatic weirdness, who is associated with, well, not inventing, but discovering poetry, bringing the mead of poetry to humankind. So again, we see the kind of two faces of this, right? Bragi, the outward face, a polished, eloquent, you know, the Prose Edda says he's the best at speech, and whenever we say that someone is whenever someone is more eloquent than anyone else, they call him Brag. But then that the origin is this darker story about Odin, which we could get into at some point, but there's a lot to cover. And finally, we have someone who's not really a god at all, but a monstrous creature. That's what here they call the Fenris Wolf, or sometimes just Fenrir. A Fenrir means fen dweller, that is someone who lives in a fen, which is like a bog. Now, Fenrir is one of the children of Loki and a giantess called Angerboda, which means sorrow bringer or sorrow like, well, I mean, it's related to our word bode, right? So like that bode's no good. So I don't quite know what that means, sorrow portender. Anyway, one of three monstrous children that they have together with the goddess Hel and the Midgard serpent, Jormungand. So Odin takes Jormungand and throws him into the sea. He takes Hel and sends her down into the underworld to rule over it. But the wolf they raise with the gods in Asgard. It's not quite clear why, but as he gets bigger and bigger, they begin to realize that he's more and more dangerous. So they come up with a series of plans to create magical fetters to tie him up with. He breaks the first two. They create the third one through a series of, you know, impossible things. So they have to find the sound of a cat's footfall and the roots of a mountain and so on to make Gleipnir this magical, you know, fetter or chain that they can tie him up with. But it just looks like a velvet band. So they go to put it on Fenrir and he says effectively, well, that looks weak. So if it is weak and I break out of it, I don't get any glory. But frankly, this seems like a trick. So I'm not going to trust you until some god is brave enough to put their hand in my mouth, and that'll be the deal, which is that you know, you tie me up and I'll bite your hand off. And Tyr, the god of war, or a god anyway, we'll talk about him when we get to him, puts his hand in Fenrir's mouth, and lo and behold, the fetter works, but Fenrir bites his hand off. So note again that this image of a ravening wolf is kind of contradicted by the fact that in this myth, Fenrir just kind of has chats with the gods, right? He's a thinking creature that can talk. But in the descriptions of Ragnarok, when he's going to return, he's portrayed as a slavering monster. And there's in the Prose Edda, there's a bit that says his upper jaw will touch the heavens and his lower jaw will touch the earth. And he would open it wider if there were room. And this image of the wolf with its gaping mouth keeps recurring through Fenrir's legend. So, for example, to prevent him from biting after they've tied him up with Gleipnir, they put a sword in his mouth with, you know, the point on his in his upper jaw and the handle in his lower jaw. And then, you know, at Ragnarok, the wolf will kill Odin. But then one of Odin's sons, Vidar, is going to come along and he's got a special magic shoe. And he's going to put his special magic shoe, which, I don't know, is Vidar in here? We'll get to him when we get to him. If not, I'll add him at the end. He's going to put his special magic shoe on the bottom jaw, and he's going to put his hands on the upper jaw, and he's just going to stretch until he snaps the wolf's jaw open. So the idea of the wolf with his enormous open mouth seems to constantly reoccur. And that's true in the art that depicts him as well. Maybe. That's a whole other topic. So Fenrir is amazing, but it's, again, it's hard to see how he turns up in your game. For one thing, if your player characters have to fight him, that boy's bite does 9d10 damage. But also, he's tied up. He's tied up with Gleipnir. Now, the myth itself is an easy one to replicate. Like, oh, there's a mighty beast that needs to be bound, and the gods want you to go get, you know, 6 impossible things to make a magic fetter out of. That's a classic. You know, it's a fetch quest with genuine mythological antecedents. So that's nice. And maybe the idea that there's some bound monstrosity that knows something or has some, you know, power that you need that you're going to have to go and talk to it while it's, you know, bound up in whatever heckish cave it's restrained in. That could also be kind of fun. There are a lot of bound monsters in Norse mythology, not just Fenrir, but also the hellhound Garm, who may be the same. There's a couple other wolves that are going to eat up the sun and moon, and they may be the wolves of Fenrir's race referred to in the Poetic Edda. And then there's Loki himself, who winds up getting bound up, and it's his thrashing in his torture that causes earthquakes. So the idea that there's a lot of evil bound in the world and it's going to burst out in an apocalypse, it's very compelling as a piece of mythology, but I actually don't know that it's what you want in a D&D game, right? Because you want the evil not to be potential, you want it to be here. You want these creatures to be out so that they can be fought. Or maybe someone's working to release them. You know, you get kind of a race against time against someone who's trying to release the wolf. The problem there, of course, is that those kinds of scenarios either end in failure or they're anticlimactic, right? If there's going to be a thing about releasing the Fenris wolf, you want to fight that bad boy at the end, and if you don't get to, you're going to be disappointed. Maybe his lesser wolf descendants are trying to free him. Maybe they're werewolves. Boy, at some point we're going to have to talk about berserkers and shape-shifting in Old Norse culture, but we're starting to run out of time for this episode. So what do we have here? We have here a lot more. I mean, Baldur is a weird figure, definitely. Aegir and Bragi seem much more like the kinds of gods that we would expect from a D&D-ish pantheon, right? Dungeons & Dragons often kind of simplifies pantheons in ways that real religions typically don't have. So who is he? Oh, god of fire, god of the sun, god of the moon, god of the sea, god of the earth, god of the sky, yada-da-da-da-da-da, right? Actual deities are typically a lot more complicated than that. But Aegir, he's the god of the sea, but then he has this other gimmick, which is this thing about hospitality. You know, Bragi's the god of poetry, but there's sort of this weird side thing to him where he's sort of a secondary god of poetry. And then we have Baldur, who's this strange figure. One who I think it could be quite tricky to use in a game, but who does have this added, this aura of mystery and tragedy that's really interesting. And he's still in hell, right? So he's a god who is dead, but who could come back later. And that's quite an interesting concept. So, you know, like Hermod, who is sometimes referred to as a god and sometimes as a mortal. Odin has mortal children and descendants as well. Well, I mean, I guess Odin is mortal. So I should say human children and descendants. You know, like Hermod, the player characters might find themselves having to go to another plane to find this dead god and, you know, ask him questions. After all, he's a wise god, right? His judgments are always true. You know, if there was a question so important that you absolutely needed to be right, you'd be like, well, we'll have to find the wisest, you know, maybe you ask some old, you know, oracle where we can find the wisest person in the world, and she tells you, oh yeah, well, actually it's hell. So you have to go there and you know, brave all kinds of dangers and terrors. And actually, the Norse underworld's pretty good value for money in that respect. Yeah, throw in a little shake of Walt Simonson, and you're good to go. Oh man, that's another thing we're going to have to talk about is the Mighty Thor, right? The Marvel comics and their influence on this. The classic Walt Simonson run actually hadn't happened yet when this book came out, but there's still a good dash of the Mighty Thor in the Norse mythology section of Deities and Demigods, for sure. Maybe there'll be a bonus episode. It's not hard to get me to talk about Walt Simonson's run of the Mighty Thor, because it's great. Anyway, so that's a fun Baldur idea. Yeah, so I mean, I guess that's the case with both Baldur and Fenrir, right? That they're deities, but they're imprisoned. It also could be a fun concept to have a cleric that doesn't have that kind of direct access to their deity. So you might get, you know, someone who is a cleric of Baldur. Well, you know, Baldur's not going to come down and, you know, do divine intervention for you. He's dead. There are actually rules about what happens when your god dies, and they're pretty brutal. I don't know if I would necessarily enforce those. You know, perhaps we could say that when he died, his parents passed on to Forseti, or we could say that, you know, even though he's in the underworld, he's still able to lend power to his followers, but there's some kind of limitation, right? I mean, So those are our first four kind of regular entries for Norse mythology. Join me next time as we talk about Fjallar, Forseti, the Fossagrim, and Frey. And frankly, this might just be mainly talking about Frey, because there's a lot to talk about with this guy. He's kind of overlooked in a lot of stories based on Norse mythology, right? Like the Thor movies, there's not a Frey character, and he's not really that important in the comics either, I don't think. Which is a shame, because Frey's got a lot going on, including, in Deities and Demigods, a swell mustache. So join me next time as we take a look at maybe the best mustache in Asgard on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting Monster Man.